Welcome to the eMental Health in Practice webinar number 67, looking at the use of smartphone apps for young people with anxiety and depression. So first of all, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the country. For me, that is the Awabakal people. I would like to pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging, and also extend my respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with us here tonight. So my name's Cathy O'Grady. I'm a GP in Newcastle with a special interest in mental health, and I'm also a facilitator with Black Dog in the professional stream. So we're very lucky tonight to have with us Dr. Imogen Bell to take us through looking at smartphone apps for depression and anxiety in young people. So Imogen is the NHNMRC Emerging Leadership Fellow and Psychologist at Origin Digital. So Origin is the National Centre for Excellence in Youth Mental Health. It's a world-leading research and knowledge translation organisation which focuses on mental ill health in young people. I think we can all feel a bit overwhelmed when we're trying to choose an e-mental health resource, and particularly an app. And I think that's even more complicated when we're looking at young people. So if we're, you know, clinicians or parents of young people, I think a lot of the time we're trying to get young people off devices. So being able to choose an app that is safe for them is particularly important. So Imogen's going to actually take us through that, the evidence of actually what's safe and what is actually helpful. So thanks, Imogen.
Very welcome. Thank you for having me, Cathy, and to MPRAC for putting together this amazing resource for mental health professionals out there. I think that you're right in that there is quite a bit of concern out there in you know, amongst various circles, parents, teachers, maybe even tech companies themselves, politicians, about the harms that technology can have on young people's lives. And certainly I think that there is some data to back that up and to suggest that we should be cautious. But something that's often not part of the conversation is how technology might actually be able to help young people. So I work within Origin in the digital arm called Origin Digital. And really what we're trying to do is understand the ways that technology can actually help young people and developing new digital treatments that might be able to address some of the major issues that are facing the young people today in terms of their mental health. So hopefully by the end of this webinar, I've convinced you all of the potential value of smartphone mental health apps for depression and anxiety in young people and helping you to navigate through some of the ways in which you can use these in your care. So just to flag the learning objectives, what I'm trying to achieve with this presentation is to outline the research evidence underlying smartphone interventions for youth depression and anxiety, including some of the gaps and the emerging innovations. You know, if we look forward over the next 5 to 10 years in this space, what are some of the technologies that we might see on the horizon and how might they be able to help young people? Outlining the ways in which smartphone interventions can support mental health treatment of young people with depression and anxiety, various different ways. I hope that you'll also be able to recall some of the currently available smartphone apps for young people. I'm going to be talking about some of the more popular ones and a new one that we've developed, or I've developed at Origin Digital, called Mellow, with some really exciting clinical trial results there. I also hope to take you through and become aware of some of the ethical considerations when using apps within routine clinical practice, including how to navigate, you know, what apps to use and what sorts of things to sort of tune into when it comes to the selection of apps if you choose to use them in your care. So these statistics will be no surprise to you, just to set the scene in terms of the problems that we're facing globally in terms of mental ill health. One in eight people have a mental health condition, and it's the world's leading cause of disability. If we hone in on the youth mental health, 20% of young people have a mental disorder, and suicide remains a leading cause of death. If we look specifically at Australia, recent data quite shockingly has shown us that mental ill health, rates of mental ill health amongst young people aged 16 to 24 years have actually doubled in the last decade, which is really staggering. So it's up around 40% of young people right now are meeting criteria for a diagnosable mental health condition. This is shocking. And meanwhile, only a third of young people receive access to treatment. The treatments that are available to young people are also really inadequate in many ways, and they're often not designed to be engaging to young people, and they're also really largely not effective enough. So this is really the landscape of the mental health crisis that we're facing in Australia and globally. So there's a fair amount of urgency in thinking through some of the innovative ways that we might be able to address these challenges. If we look specifically at depression and anxiety in youth, these are the most prevalent and debilitating conditions in youth populations. The graph on the left there is from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It's a few years old now, but it shows how the youth period is a peak time in which mental ill health is likely to develop. So 75% of mental disorders actually develop during adolescence in that early age and kind of reduces over time. But youth is a particularly vulnerable period for young people's mental health. And it's a phase in which we really have an opportunity to intervene early so we can help course correct the trajectory that young people might be on in terms of their mental ill health into adulthoods. So there's an opportune time in the youth period. However, as I mentioned before, the treatments that we have available really aren't effective enough. Firstly, a lot of young people don't actually seek help in the first place. Many reasons for this, things like the cost, geographical isolation, the fact that young people aren't really, you know, always necessarily in charge and able to seek their own help. You know, they have to go via their parents or their teachers or some other adults. And a lot of the stigma and shame associated with mental ill health can really act as important barriers there to young people actually reaching out when they need it. And when they do get through the door, the effect sizes for the best available treatments that we have are really only modest at best. If you look over the past 50 years, the research literature, the effects of treatments, of the best available treatments that we have really stagnated. In fact, there's some evidence that they're growing worse over time. Really, after 50 years of research, you would start to expect some breakthroughs, but this really isn't happening. So we're stagnating in terms of our the progress that we're making in the field. And all of this contributes to really high rates of recurrence and relapse. So young people, when they do receive help, they tend to continue to have episodes of mental ill health for prolonged periods of time. And as I mentioned before, we have very high rates of dropout as well. The treatments that are available to young people just don't seem to fit their needs. So switching now to think about how technology might be able to address this growing crisis in youth mental health. Well, we know from the data that at least in high-income countries, technology ownership is around 90% amongst youth. And young people use technology really frequently throughout their everyday lives. I mean, you know, anybody who has a teenager around them is probably aware of how often they are on their phones, which can be a concern to some parents. But to switch your mindset for a moment, if 40% of the young people out there are struggling with their mental health and so few of them are getting access to the treatment that they need, imagine if every time they were looking at their smartphone, they were actually getting help for their mental health. That's a pretty powerful potential, and it really hits home some of the key opportunities here that have been raised in the literature around how digital technologies might be able to help. Actually being able to integrate routine treatment with technology means that we can potentially support young people's mental health 24/7. It offers added convenience and anonymity. As I mentioned before, mental health stigma and the barriers around help seeking, the opportunity to actually be able to seek and receive help through, say, a smartphone app without any barriers at all, even potentially you could get it for free, is quite significant in addressing a lot of the concerns that young people have in going to traditional services. It also can make therapy more interesting, engaging, and fun. You know, those dropout rates that I mentioned earlier are quite staggering, and you know, the research that we've done and others have done have shown that the services that are out there really aren't meeting the needs of young people in these sorts of ways. They sort of feel old school and, you know, boring, or, you know, not fully integrated with the realities of their own world, you know, despite the fact that we have the Headspace model, which is really designed to, you know, overcome some of those barriers. Still, nonetheless, we see young people struggling to stay engaged. If we look at mental health apps in particular, I'm sure you all use mental health apps or just regular apps, maybe not mental health apps. I know I use mental health apps, but I'm sure you're aware of the array of different types of apps that you can download on your phone. But when we talk about mental health apps, what we're talking about here is apps accessed on smartphone, which contain features designed to support and improve mental health in some way. And the common features of mental health apps specifically include things like self-monitoring, so actually tracking moods and symptoms. Any clinician out there that's done cognitive behavioral therapy is probably given a printed out worksheet and encouraged somebody to track their moods and their thoughts and their situations. Mental health apps often provide an opportunity to do that digitally in a more sort of convenient and automated way. We also see common features around brief guided self-management techniques, so sort of exercises such as thought challenging that you might see in CBT or certain mindfulness techniques. And some of these offer some form of gamification as well, so elements which might make the exercise fun or challenging, or frame it in a way, or have certain components like rewards, for example, that might motivate engagement. And journaling is a very common one. Ecological momentary assessment and intervention is a bit of a technical term from the research literature. I did my PhD in these technologies, but ecological momentary assessment is about using mobile devices to conduct assessments that are about capturing experiences as they happen in the moment. And doing this repeatedly over time. So that is really about capturing a more ingrained level of detail when we're conducting our assessment that has more real world validity, but also looking at how different symptoms might fluctuate over time and the different dynamics that might sort of play out in different contexts and environments in everyday life. And then ecological momentary intervention is the same principle of applied to interventions. So actually delivering interventions in daily life at precise moments where people might need particular type of support. And then you're probably all familiar with the mindfulness and relaxation type apps like Smiling Mind and Headspace and Calm. These are the most popular ones. You probably have come across these in your practice. You may recommend some of them. You may use some of them yourself. I certainly do. They are the most popular. And chatbots are becoming more commonplace too, particularly as a feature. You could imagine a sort of thought challenging type chatbot, for example, which talks young people through, you know, a way to reframe a particular bias that they might be having about a situation in the moment that it's sort of playing out. So chatbots in that sort of Socratic questioning style are starting to emerge a fair bit in the CBT space. So in terms of the potential benefits here, so obviously I've spoken to the idea of increasing the accessibility of treatment, particularly in remote areas, rural and remote areas where, you know, young people might be particularly isolated. They can't make their way all the way to a Headspace service or their local GP or mental health clinic. And they may not have school counselors in their school or at the local university. So particular geographical distances, there's a lot of opportunity for young people facing those challenges. Potential reduction in treatment costs and wait times. This is something that's mentioned as a real potential benefit. I don't think that the research data has really corroborated that statement quite yet. But certainly, if you could imagine that, you know, young people were accessing a mental health app which actually met their mental health needs, rather than, you know, relying on a psychologist or other services, then that would potentially reduce cost and the wait times for services which are really struggling with demand at the moment, in particular. fostering self-management and empowerment. I'm sure you're aware of the value of actually putting people in the driver's seat of their own mental health care. So actually giving them, you know, tools and resources that they can, you know, choose to use in their own way in order to dictate and direct their mental health journey could be particularly empowerful. Young people really emphasize this aspect when we speak to them. In Origin, and within Origin Digital, we work really closely with lots and lots of young people in trying to understand you know, youth mental health from many different angles. And when we speak to them about digital mental health, this is something that repeatedly comes up, that, you know, they like to be in charge and they like to be empowered to take the lead. And these tools give them that opportunity. Greater anonymity, I mentioned before, this real opportunity to, you know, have young people have very, very little barriers to accessing mental health supports. Remote monitoring of risk and treatment progress. This is probably something that we haven't seen implemented well. I don't think that there's a whole lot of apps out there that are doing this at the moment, but certainly in the literature, there's quite a few clinical trials of apps that have shown that, you know, the benefits of remote monitoring of risk. Of risk in particular, so identifying early signs of relapse, or, you know, even identifying signs of young people who might be, you know, starting to show, you know, early signs of mental ill health, and looping them in with treatment at that early phase. More accurate and reliable assessment in daily life. So I mentioned that ecological momentary assessment before. You know, the bread and butter of psychological treatment in particular, and many other sort of mental health sort of approaches, is really having an understanding an accurate picture of what the presentation is. You know, how does this play out in your daily life? What are the triggers? What's going on? You know, how do you respond to that? And that formulation really drives the treatment focus. And the data from smartphone apps can actually capture that in a very reliable way. So you might not have that issue of, you know, asking a young person what their triggers are and they say, oh, I don't know, I don't remember. Real-time momentary intervention and support. So similarly, actually giving young people delivering interventions to them at a time that it's actually needed. So I'm sure many of you will have struggled with the idea of, you know, a young person comes into your office and they talk about a particular challenging incident that they might have had during the prior week. And, you know, you might talk to them about some strategies that could help next time, but they typically forget as soon as they walk out the office. And it's really at those moments in daily life, because mental health plays out in context. You know, it plays out, you know, in relationships and in situations that we're in, and it's triggered and it's dynamic. And so being able to provide interventions at those precise moments is something that really we are essentially not able to do in many circumstances in the current traditional treatments that we have. Customization and adaptation to individual circumstances. So there's capacity there for the smartphone apps to actually tailor treatment based on, you know, how a young person interacts with the app or what else it might know about them, to actually give them a more sort of personalized treatment approach. And these mediums, these platforms can be really engaging and motivating. You know, I mentioned the gamification elements like rewards and challenges and things like this. Those can all serve to sort of boost engagement, which, as I mentioned before, is a big issue with young people. Young people also like find they get very engaged by like elements of apps that are sort of cute or funny or, you know, personalized. Like there's examples of apps where you have to kind of nurture a little tree and it grows. And every time you do an activity, there's, you know, you get a new leaf on the tree. And even very basic things like this can be very captivating to young people. The Sleep Ninja app that I'll mention later on, developed by Black Dog, is a great example of this too. There's a cute little like ninja that guides you through the treatment, and it's oriented towards helping young people develop better sleep habits. But these sorts of things can be very engaging and compelling to young people as a motivator. When we ask young people about their perspectives, they're also strongly supportive of digital mental health apps. We conducted this survey back during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic in Australia, and we wanted to understand what the impacts of COVID-19 was on young people's mental health, their well-being and functioning. But we were really also interested in the ways in which digital technology might be able to help support young people's mental health through the pandemic and beyond. Some publications there from the BRACE survey. What we found was that smartphone ownership was universal. So close to 100% of young people in the sample were using smartphone apps. This is young people within the general population, within services as well, including primary and specialist services. We also surveyed clinicians about their perspectives as well. We found that 63% of young people used smartphones several times an hour, 80% every hour. So they're frequently using technologies in their everyday lives. And I'm sure you're well aware of this. Any young person you see out there, 90% of the time, they probably do have their phone somewhere within their reach. In terms of use and interest, so 88% of young people and 100% of clinicians were at least somewhat interested in different ways that digital technologies could support mental health. They were particularly interested in blended therapies. And what blended therapies means is it's the use of technology in conjunction with some sort of face-to-face support. This is really where we think the most significant role that technology can play in supporting mental health across the board will be. So this is really about, looking at how technologies can be integrated within care systems. So I'll talk about the literature later and the research evidence and the findings, but what we do see is that these tools are much more effective when they're used in conjunction with some sort of human support. So we are not interested in replacing human support in any way. This is about enriching and enhancing the care that clinicians provide using technology in various ways. As a kind of adjunct, you might think of this as, in the same way that you work with maybe physios or dietitians or GPs, in your care of young people. It really, it takes an army sometimes to really tackle this from various angles. And really, I'd like to emphasize that technology can be one aspect of that care. Maybe for some young people, all they need is an app, but for many young people struggling with mental ill health, they're going to need, all hands on deck to help them to recover. So certainly this interest in blended therapies amongst young people and clinicians is backed up by the evidence and certainly our position. They are interested in smartphone apps and online therapies and interestingly social media to connect with other young people experiencing mental ill health as well. In terms of the apps that are being used, so half of young people had used a mental health app and 84% of clinicians had recommended an app to their clients. 86% of young people found the apps at least somewhat helpful, and 94% of clinicians felt that the apps were helpful to their clients. So this is a promising picture. So young people are already using mental health apps, clinicians are already recommending mental health apps, and it seems as though, these are generally helpful, which is really great. The most popular ones are in the space of mindfulness, meditation, relaxation, mood monitoring and safety planning. The ones that are listed there, Smiling Mind, Headspace, Calm, these are the ones that have the strongest sort of market presence. They're the ones that are, Smiling Mind, I believe, is free. Headspace and Calm aren't, but they tend to charge a fair bit and, they have big business models behind them. So they have a lot of advertising. I think they get the word out very effectively. I'll touch on this later in terms of the evidence base, but they have some evidence, but not a whole lot. Clinicians are more likely to recommend apps to young people than young people are to use them. What that means is that, you may go ahead and recommend a young person uses an app. That doesn't mean that they're going to go ahead and do it. And that is totally fine. Again, this is about empowering young people to take charge in how they want to lead their own mental health care. And if an app's a part of it, that's great. But if not, that's fine. And it doesn't mean that you can't recommend it or suggest it, but we follow their lead. And the most popular apps actually have weak evidence. Some of these apps have some evidence base, but not in youth, certainly not in in sort of established mental ill health in youth. When we ask young people what they think, this comes from an interesting study that asked young people their thoughts on various popular apps for depression and anxiety. They said that it's important that the apps be personalized to them, from the content to the appearance. They need to be simple to use, easy to access and navigate. They need to be carefully worded to gain credibility, but they can't overwhelm with information. This is, as somebody who designs and develops apps and writes content for apps, it is really tricky to strike that balance, because we all sort of tend to want to give too much information. Essentially, the talent is in working with designers, excellent designers, essentially, that can translate some of these ideas and this information into an engaging sort of format. Apps, again, they should complement and not replace face-to-face care. So as I mentioned earlier, this is something that clinicians feel as well and is backed up by the research data. Features to support motivation. So this is kind of the gamification stuff, missions, objectives, rewards, mood tracking, things like this. And they should be freely accessible. In terms of the evidence, so these studies are from mental health apps across the board, across different clinical conditions in adults and in youth. And the findings that we see here is essentially that smartphone mental health apps can be effective at treating mental health conditions. The effect sizes are sort of in the small to moderate range. And this is relative to control groups as well. Apps are more effective when guidance or support is offered. So those effect sizes are larger when there's some human involved in supporting the app use. The effects are consistent across clinical and subclinical groups. The effects are kind of less stable or clear when there's an active comparison being used. So when you compare a group that used a mental health app to a group that, say, just tracked something over a period of time, it seems like the effects are smaller. And what this may suggest is that some of the effect of mental health apps on improving mental health outcomes might be to do with the fact that you're just using a piece of technology and paying attention to your mental health in some way. So this is kind of speaks to some of those generalized effects that we actually also see in psychological therapies when we use control groups like befriending or supportive counseling. Engagement with apps does tend to be poor. So we see a drop off quite rapidly in engagement over time. The apps that are based on CBT principles are generally more effective than mindfulness apps. In the youth mental health literature specifically, there's a lot less studies that have been conducted and less sort of meta-analytic reviews that can really synthesize all the findings together and give us as much of a detailed picture. There are a limited number of studies, but there is evidence that apps can be effective for some conditions. The effects are larger, again, when used in conjunction with human support, but the engagement with apps tends to be poor. This study raises an important point in that it looked at the apps that were available for child and adolescent anxiety on the App Store, and they reviewed the content that was within those apps, and they found that the evidence-based content was quite rare. So when we think about, you know, just going onto the App Store and downloading an app immediately, you know, type in child and adolescent anxiety, you download the first thing that you see, the likelihood of that app actually containing, you know, proper evidence-based content is low. So just beware. And I'll have some suggestions for how you can kind of navigate that complexity a little bit later on. I want to switch for a second and talk about transdiagnostic approaches and their relevance to this discussion, because I think as a field we are becoming more transdiagnostic in the way that we think and the way that we approach mental health conditions. I think clinicians are doing this anyway, but essentially what this comes down to is that comorbidity is a problem in mental health science and in mental health treatment. So mental disorders have very high rates of comorbidity. If a young person walks through your door and you diagnose them with anxiety, the chances that they'll also be diagnosed with a depressive disorder or some other emotional disorder is very high. The issue with this is that you've got clients that have a very mixed bag of different diagnoses. It makes us question what the utility of those diagnoses are. You know, if fundamentally diagnosis is about treatment planning, you know, a diagnosis leads to a treatment, then how useful is that diagnosis if people meet multiple criteria? And I do wonder, I'm a clinician myself, psychologist myself. I have a PhD in clinical psychology, so I've done the clinical training. And, you know, I've really found diagnoses rarely particularly helpful, to be honest. What was really helpful was the formulation with people sitting down and understanding their problems. And what we find is usually that there are underlying problems that cut across these conditions. I'll talk about in a second. But essentially, this makes treatment difficult for lots of different ways. It's essentially very poorly targeted and lacks specificity, and it wastes time and resources because clinicians are often using trial and error. The transdiagnostic approach suggests that the reason why there's comorbidity is that there's common underlying causes or mechanisms which might be driving those conditions. And transdiagnostic treatments are about targeting those underlying mechanisms more directly or applying the same sorts of treatments across different diagnoses. So acceptance and commitment therapy, for example, will work and can be applied across depression, anxiety, multiple different disorders. The benefits of a transdiagnostic approach is that it has more universal applicability across diagnoses. It can be more personalized and targeted and potentially, you know, more effective if we target those underlying core mechanisms, then maybe we will lead to greater effects rather than just the overarching symptoms. I'm particularly, in my area of research, interested in repetitive negative thinking, otherwise known as worry and rumination. This is a particularly prevalent and potent transdiagnostic mechanism that has decades of research that has supported its role in multiple mental health conditions, particularly depression and anxiety, including and in youth. A young person's perspective here, it's like a cycle. You get stuck, you feel stupid about it, then you feel stupid for feeling stupid, you feel pathetic and helpless. So it's a it's a developing snowball effect of negative thoughts and emotion that build over time. And when we look at the literature, if you target repetitive negative thinking in psychological treatment, we see improvements in depression and anxiety. So as a core focus of psychological treatment for young people with depression and anxiety, repetitive negative thinking or worry rumination, what we call stuck thinking, is very important. So that's just a message there. All of this knowledge and work led us to develop an app called Mellow. So Mellow offers evidence-based techniques to break the cycle of stuck thinking in the moment. So it does this via lots of different features. Young people can get instant relief from stuck thinking by pressing a button in the app, which tailors a recommendation for a brief interactive exercise that they can do in the moment that's designed to unhook them from negative thoughts. This comes from, we basically looked at the literature over the last 40 years, and we identified the most effective evidence-based psychological intervention strategies for stuck thinking or repetitive negative thinking. And we translated them into the app. So all of the exercises in Mellow are based on various different techniques, including things like cognitive diffusion, mindfulness, relaxation, self-compassion, problem solving. All of these have been translated into the app, and they all target that underlying mechanism of stuck thinking. In 2021, we conducted a clinical trial, which has just been published. It just published late last year. We ran a randomized control trial. So half of young people used Mellow for 6 weeks and the other half didn't use Mellow. So that was a control group. And we were really interested in understanding, you know, would young people use Mellow and what the impact was on their mental health. We had some really exciting results. So 86% of young people that we offered to take part in Mellow said that they wanted to, they went ahead. So this really speaks to, you know, the idea that when you offer mental health tools to young people, they are interested in taking them up. 96% of the young people who used Mellow would recommend it to others. And 60% of them were using Mellow at 6 weeks. This is a really high level of sustained engagement. typically we see a very rapid drop off, you know, down to maybe even, you know, as low as 5% of young people using apps by this period of time, even at the third week. So this is really promising results that we saw Mellow being used for that long. And I think that it speaks to the fact that or the likelihood rather that Mellow is helping them with a problem that they're experiencing in a way that is useful to them. And it's also an engaging app. It's a really beautiful app that's been designed by wonderful designers. So it's engaging and it fits their needs. When we look at the effects, so 80% of the Mellow users saw an improvement in depression and anxiety and stuck thinking. And if we look at the size of that improvement compared to the control group, we saw moderate to large effect sizes. So this is really great. And the size of those effects are about on par with what we typically see with current evidence-based approaches that involve 6 to 10 sessions with a psychologist. So young people were using Mellow completely on their own without any sort of guidance. So that is really promising. The improvements in depression and anxiety were driven by reductions in stuck thinking. So when we targeted stuck thinking specifically, what we saw was that there were flow-on improvements to depression and anxiety, which really supports that underlying theory about targeting those transdiagnostic mechanisms directly. Young people liked Mellow. They found it easy and comfortable to use, and it fit an important need. Importantly, Mellow is now available on the App Store and Google Play Store. That video is even a little bit old now that the Mellow app's been improved even more and expanded range. It's got a new look and feel. So go ahead and download it and try it yourself and recommend it to young people if you want to.
Imogen, just getting a few questions about the Mellow app.
Yeah.
One is about the age group that it's targeted for.
Yes. So the clinical trial was in young people aged 16 to 25 with clinical depression and anxiety. So that's the validated group. It's particularly suited for that group. But I think that younger people would also be suitable for Mellow as well. The evidence-based strategies that Mellow is based on has been validated in younger adolescents. It's just that the content has been written with a slightly older demographic in mind.
Great. And what about the evidence of its use for people with neurodiverse conditions, so autism, ADHD?
Yeah, great question. The simple answer is we don't have that evidence yet. We've just started with the core population, depression and anxiety. But what we're really interested in is adapting Mellow for other priority groups, particularly even culturally and linguistically diverse groups as well, translating to different languages, making sure that it's culturally appropriate for different groups as well, including Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders. So we've still yet to do that work.
And one more question about if somebody's not kind of happy to give an email address, can they still use the app?
An email address is required to sign up, unfortunately.
Yeah.
My answer to that.
Thank you. Okay. I think that's good. Thank you.
Other evidence-based app. I didn't want to just talk about Mellow, although that's the one that I've developed, and it certainly is an important resource out there for young people, for Australian young people. But there are others too. So Sleep Ninja is a great free mental health app for sleep problems in youth. Clearly Me, designed to improve mental health outcomes, Australian adolescents with depression and anxiety. Brave Online is a great one. And the Most app, which is also from Origin Digital, this one is designed, it's mainly accessed online, but it's also available via an app. This is for young people receiving care from youth mental health services specifically at the moment, but in future it might be directly accessible as well. There are other apps that may help youth. Smiling Mind, Headspace, Reach Out, Worry Time is great. Stay Strong app is a First Nations app. These ones do not have specific evidence in youth. They have some evidence in adults. Headspace does. I don't think Smiling Mind or Calm does, actually, but they're based on mindfulness. So again, they've got evidence-based content in them. So worth a mention, but not specifically for youth. The emerging areas in this space, there's a lot of excitement about artificial intelligence, particularly in the area of, you know, personalizing treatments and using massive amounts of data on the individual level or the group level to really identify, you know, clinically meaningful patterns. So, for example, you know, identifying, you know, certain signs of risk of relapse in a manic episode from the way people use, you know, their phones. Digital phenotyping is looking at the data of how people are interacting with their devices or their apps to also lead to early detection or changes in mental health. Wearables is a popular space, so tracking things like heart rate or other signs of stress or sort of biomarkers that can be used to, you know, monitor and detect signs of need for mental health support or tailor that treatment. Digital ecosystems is interesting. It's this idea of using multiple different devices to support people in different ways. Just-in-time adaptive interventions is a bit of a jargony term, but I thought it worth mentioning because they're becoming very popular and in the research space. This is, Mello's actually a basic just-in-time adaptive intervention, but this is about using smartphone data to identify moments where an individual might be in need of support. So, you know, escalating towards a manic episode or potentially at risk of, you know, relapsing if they're suffering from substance use disorder, and then delivering interventions, tailored interventions at those precise moments. So actually detecting and delivering interventions at really, you know, personalized moments in daily life. A lot of interest about how AI could be integrated within those approaches as well. The challenges, just to finish up, one of the big challenges is indeed implementation. So there are a lot of different apps out there for different purposes. It can make it very difficult to select which apps to use. And in reality, you may actually need to use multiple apps for different things. If you've got a young person struggling with sleep and worry, then you may be recommending Mello and Sleep Ninja. Can get complicated. But you really need to prioritize individual preferences. So putting young people, you know, in charge of how they want tech to be integrated in their care. Integrating these technologies within services can also be really complex because they're not always designed to be seamlessly transferable within different contexts. As you all picked up, engagement and privacy and data security are big issues. So I've already mentioned that long-term engagement is a problem in this field. We see this very clearly in the real world and also in clinical trials, although engagement tends to be higher in clinical trials in the real world. We don't really have very good definitions of what we mean by engagement. You know, do we really actually want young people using mental health apps forever? Or is a slow drop off of engagement, assuming that they get what they need, actually, you know, what we do want? So we're trying to understand that better in research. Privacy and data security are issues in particularly in kind of market, you know, big marketed apps like Headspace and Calm. A lot of the time, mental health apps don't have clear privacy policies. So this is something that I'd really, you know, emphasize and warn you about, that the privacy policies can, you know, often use the data in ways that are, you know, not ethical. And the apps that are used the most are not the ones with the most evidence base to support them. So one study found that only 1% of commercially available apps had any independent research evidence support the effectiveness of it. So again, that example of going onto the app store and searching anxiety app, the first thing you see may not have any evidence base to it. And likewise, young people may be facing the same challenges. So all of this makes it really hard to choose and recommend mental health apps. This framework here is a really popular one that was developed, and it's essentially a set of questions that you might want to ask yourself and maybe even work through with young people. You know, a big role of the clinicians in this this emerging technology revolution is about educating young people about what to look for. It's not just about, you know, yourselves and what you might recommend, but it's also about telling young people, you know, go ahead and try what you want, but these are some of the questions that you might want to ask yourself. You'll start to see this expectation happening more and more. So can the data be easily shared and interpreted in a way that's consistent with the stated purpose of the app? Does the app seem easy to use? So a lot of this is going to be about downloading these apps and trying them yourselves and reviewing the content and sussing out if it's legitimate, because A lot of them may not have a clinical trial to back up their results, but they may be based on clinical interventions that have an established evidence base like mindfulness. So, you know, you are going to be a good judge of that, of the validity of that content. Is there evidence from rigorous research? Something like Mellow and Sleep Ninja, which have rigorous clinical trials, are safe bets. But, you know, there may be young people struggling with other problems, and there may be apps out there that you want to try that don't have that evidence base. Does the app have a clinical recovery foundation that's relevant to your intended use? So the problems that young people are struggling with, is the app designed for that? Is the risk, is the privacy policy transparent, clear, and accessible? Does the app collect, use, or transmit sensitive data? If you go onto apps these days on the app stores, you can see, if you scroll down, how they're using your data, and you'll see what's being collected. And then you've got to, you know, follow up by reading the privacy policy to understand how that information might be used. And which platform does the program work on, and has it been updated? There's a lot of apps out there that are just really ancient and outdated, and they're not really, they're essentially unstable and unreliable.
So Imogen, one more question about apps. There's a question about, do we know what the difference of with engagement is with an app versus face-to-face therapy?
Yes. So that's a great question, because we see disengagement with both, don't we? Mm-hmm. We see dropout. Typically, I think it's about 40% of young people tend to drop out by the third session of psychological treatment. So that's only after a handful of weeks. We see similar drop-offs. It's hard to compare because apps are being used continuously, usually, rather than, you know, session by session like a psychologist would. But we see a reduction in engagement over time. Interestingly, in the research space, there doesn't seem to be, this strange thing, it doesn't seem to be a correlation between the level of engagement, so how much a young person uses the app, and how much their mental health might improve after using it. So you'd think there'd be a linear engagement. The more they use it, the better they get, but that doesn't seem to be the case. So this engagement piece is quite a complex area of literature and digital mental health. Hopefully that answers the question.
No, that does. Thank you.
And to finish up, directing you to trusted solutions. So MPRAC is going to be your go-to resource for finding digital mental health tools, including apps, not just in the youth mental health space, but across the board. They've done an incredible job at keeping up to date with the developments. There are so many things being released all of the time, and keeping across all of this is, you know, several full-time jobs. And luckily, MPRAC have those several full-time, wonderful people working on it so that they can do the hard work for you. So just be aware that and these other resources are there to sort of help guide you along the way. To bring it to a close and summarize the key points, so anxiety and depression, you know, they're really common and debilitating, and they're increasing, the problems are getting worse out there, and the treatments that we have really aren't effective enough. Technology is one solution, including smartphone apps. Young people have apps, there's an appetite for them, including amongst fellow clinicians. Young people want simple but personalized apps that are effective, and we think that there's a lot of potential in this transdiagnostic space, particularly when it comes to some of the mechanisms that might be, you know, really effectively targeted by smartphone interventions, including apps like Mellow, but other ones like Sleep Ninja as well are really excellent examples that you can go away and download. In terms of issues, clinical integration, long-term engagement, privacy and security concerns are common, and you already have those concerns, so you're already tapped into the right sorts of things. But app evaluation frameworks and the resources like MPRAC can really help assist you in navigating that landscape if you choose to go ahead and use apps in your practice.
So we have one more question too from Mark, who I think is a good question to end on. The gamified therapy exercises. So basically, is there good therapy that can look like a game?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the areas that I'm really fascinated by. I'm also work in virtual reality. Actually, we're building a kind of virtual reality gamified acceptance commitment therapy treatment. But yes, there are tons of ways that you can use gamified elements to make make therapy fun. And in fact, when you speak with young people about this, they have lots of ideas about how to do that too. So it's certainly possible. Download Sleep Ninja. I think it's got a great a cool example of that.
Thank you so much, Imogen, again, for an amazingly interesting and helpful, clinically helpful talk. Mellow is very exciting, and I think everyone's downloading it, and I've certainly done that and been using it with my young people. So thank you. If you want to look at some more of the webinars, all previous 66 webinars are on the Health Professional Hub, so you can look at them there. And there's also, they've all been converted to podcasts as well. But while you're at the hub, there's also the Mental Health Community of Practice, which is a multidisciplinary community. Anybody's working in mental health, and that is working at, I guess, helping us to look at e-mental health and integrate that into our practice. But also, it's a very supportive community. So a few things going on there. There's a case that gets popped up, and you can contribute to how that case is managed, or just watch and see how we all do it differently. There's forums and blogs as well. So definitely go and join that if you're not signed up already. So again, thank you to Imogen for such an amazing talk. And thank you everybody for being here, for popping your stuff in the chat and your questions and your participation.